In this edition of Earth Ancients Special Edition, The Archives, we hear from Egyptian engineer Robert Bival in a 2014 interview where he discusses being incriminated by Zahi Hawass for the work of two German archaeologists who were studying the interior portions of the Great Pyramid and took samples to be studied and analyzed back home in Germany. Not only do we hear about the accusations against Robert Bival, in later portions of the interview, we hear about his discoveries, his evaluations and conclusions on how the pyramids were built and what the purpose of the Great Pyramid was. All this and more on Earth Ancients Special Edition, The Archives. For Monday, August 8th, 2022, this is Earth Ancients, Special Edition, The Archives. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning. A number of weeks since we have delved into the Earth Ancients archives, and today on the special edition, the archives program, we got a good one for you. In 2014, I interviewed the Egyptian engineer Robert Bival and was questioning him on a book that he had written at the time called The Secret Chamber Revisited. And this is a controversial book simply because it delves into not only the research that he had conducted with people like Graham Hancock, Robert Schock, John Anthony West, and many others, but he had a run-in with at the time, the Minister of Antiquities, Zahi Hawass, regarding some hieroglyphs and a number of cartouches that were found on the inner chamber walls of the Sphinx. This is an assertion that Zahi made against Robert Bival. This is, you know, many years ago. And we're going to talk about this today. In fact, the interview opens with this question, why this chamber was breached by two German archaeologists. And their attempt to scratch off some of the paint from the cartouche in this chamber to analyze it, to get to the bottom of who actually built the pyramids. Now, the Egyptians have a identity crisis, and when anyone from another country comes and wants to do some research, the amount of effort and money that is demanded in some cases is ridiculous, and this is why we don't see a hell of a lot of research done outside of the Germans, who have been in Egypt for over 100 years, plus excavating and paying along the way. But there are a great deal of mysteries regarding, you know, who built the pyramid, how long ago it was built. The general narrative is that Khufu, 2500 BC, had the pyramids built. If you've been listening, we've had a number of people on the show that believe that Khufu actually did repairs to the existing, not only Sphinx, but the pyramid itself. And it's odd that they, in the face of new data, they continue to hold on to that narrative and have trouble even considering any other alternative thinking on this. But Zahi Hawass has had a run-in with Robert Bivol for years. And as you'll hear on this interview today, Bivol is not only brilliant, but he comes up with quite a bit of information that makes us think about who the builders of the pyramid could have been. And more importantly, what was the purpose of the Great Pyramid? Why was it built in the first place? Why was it a line? Remember, Orion Mystery tells us, according to Bivol, that the entire complex was built in alignment with the Orion constellation. Why they did this is such a huge mystery that Bivol and Graham Hancock try to make sense of it. The Egyptological community still to this day does not adhere to any kind of notion that the pyramid was aligned to any constellation. They continue to think it's a great tomb. And I've been inside this pyramid, the Great Khufu Pyramid, the Great Pyramid itself, many times, and recorded all kinds of video footage to basically show that it is a machine. It's carved with such a level of perfection that it's like unheard of in terms of the tolerances of stone upon stone. And, you know, three different kinds of stone were used. We don't know what the cutting machinery was. Egyptology fails miserably when it comes to trying to tell us that they used dorate balls to cut and form these perfectly cut granite, red granite, which, by the way, is extremely hard, stone, and position 50-ton blocks of these granite sections into this interior of the pyramid. The other complete joke is that when you go to the great museums in Egypt, they'll show you copper tools and wooden mallets as the source of the cutting instruments. You know, it's getting to be more and more of a joke. And this is when we have people like Kara Cooney, Dr. Cooney on the program, who is herself an Egyptologist, when she says things like Egyptology is dead. Well, this is one of the reasons it is dead, is they can't even consider a multidisciplinary approach. When another science comes in and says something different than their narrative, they're all up in arms. So within a generation, if it's not completely refaced and reorganized, Egyptology will be eventually dead, in the same way that I think archaeology will fall on its own sword, so to speak. When we, you know, and we'll just take a side note on that thought. I discovered, and a number of other researchers have discovered, that the Mayanists are going it alone. They have decided that they're not going to speak with the current scientists, the Mayan day keepers, shaman who are still here. They would rather go it alone and guess their way through tens of thousands of years of Mayan history and tell us their best guess. Unfortunately, Egyptology, archaeology, when they guess, it gets put in history books, and this is our history, and this is why there's a huge, huge problem when these guys are writing up material, not telling people that it's a hypothesis or a guess. They're saying, well, this is what we think, and this is what's going to happen. So this is why Zahi Hawass gets very upset when he's talking with Graham Hancock, Robert Bivol, Robert Schock, John Anthony West, and many others, is that he can't stomach the narrative. And so we get the same old story that the dynastic Egyptians built the pyramids. Anyhow, today, this program, again, was recorded in 2014. And the details, again, open with this these two German archaeologists scratching the cartouche. You can even consider it graffiti. Thousands of years ago, this graffiti was placed above the king's chamber. We open with that, and then we get into some of the other engineering feats that have been attempted in the Great Pyramid to find out more details. So This is a nice look at Robert Bivol. And I want to mention that this was the last time I was able to get him on the program. He fell ill shortly after this interview. And to this day, I have not been able to get a hold of him. The word is that he's been very, very ill. And thankfully, he's recovered. So hopefully in the near future, we'll get him back as kind of a welcome Robert Bivol to Earth Ancients, you know, where have you been kind of thing. So we hope that he's doing well, is all I got to say. So really, really good interview on many levels. And it's always fun to have him on the program. So here is Robert Bivol on Secret Chamber Revisited.
Program, Robert Bivol. I just want to give our audience a little idea about who you are. Robert Bivol began studying ancient Egypt and Giza pyramids in 1983. The acclaimed discoverer of the Orion correlation theory, he is the author of several books including Black Genesis, Breaking the Mirror of Heaven, The Vatican Heresy, and the bestsellers The Orion Mystery and Message from the Sphinx. So, welcome to the program, Robert.
It's a pleasure.
Yes. So the big question most of us in America have is this: the claim by Hawass that in last year the two German student archaeologists entered the King's Chamber, climbed to the highest level, a place known as
Campbell's Room,
chamber, and scratched some of the cartouche or the graffiti of King Khufu. And Zawahi Hawass accused you of being the mastermind behind this crime.
Now, absolutely.
In the book, this is the last part of the book, but because we didn't really get the final phase of this, what can you tell us?
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me fill you in, as they say.
Sure.
The story begins really on the 17th of April. Last year, in 2013, when two Germans, one called Dominik Gorlitz and another one called Stefan Erdmann. Now, Stefan Erdmann is a writer of ancient mysteries. He wrote several books in German. I don't think they're in English. But basically, what you need to know is that Stefan Erdmann has actually lived in Egypt for quite a while. And has been visiting the Giza Necropolis, where the pyramids are and the Sphinx, for the last 40 years. So that's Stefan Erdmann. Dominik Gorlitz is a experimental archaeologist. He has a PhD in experimental archaeology. Just as a curiosity, Dominik Gorlitz is the successor to the famous Swedish explorer Thor Heyerdahl.
Oh my God!
Remember Thor Heyerdahl and the Kon-Tiki?
Yes, of course.
Right. So Dominik Gorlitz is actually has a society with the son of Thor Heyerdahl. I used to know Thor Heyerdahl, by the way.
Wow!
And his real interest is ancient navigation. He's about to launch an Egyptian style, ancient Egyptian style boat to prove again that the Atlantic can be crossed. Anyway, so that's Dominik Gorlitz. Dominik Gorlitz had never been to Egypt. So here we are, these two guys applied for a private visit permit to enter the Great Pyramid outside normal hours. One of the curiosity about visiting the Great Pyramid is that between the hours of 8 o'clock in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon, this is normal hours. And you buy a ticket and you go in with the rest of the tourists. Whereas you can apply for a private visit permit, which goes through a travel agent, a registered travel agent, who applies to the Ministry of Antiquities, and they allocate a day and a date. Usually it's in the morning between 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. Or in the evening, usually between 6 and 8. It's a two-hour permit, okay? So, you're still there?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to ask you, because occasionally I'm worried that the phone cuts off.
Oh, no.
I'm holding a hand.
Yeah, we're on Skype, and so it's a good connection. I hear you perfectly.
Excellent.
Okay.
So, okay, excellent.
Yeah.
So, okay, fine.
So go ahead.
All right, so that's the scene, and they got a permit through this travel agent to enter the pyramid on the 17th of April at between 6 and 8 in the evening. They had requested, I mean, oddly enough, they had requested to have a 5-meter ladder available. Now, this is very unusual because that's not normally part of the visit. But anyway, here they went to the pyramid on that prescribed time and date, and they were met by the travel agent who asked for the permit, by another five people from the Egyptian side. There were, I think, three inspectors from the Antiquity Department and two security police.
So they had three inspectors with them on their when they went up to the to the Campbell's chamber?
Let me
go ahead. Yeah,
it's important because you've asked me, you know, people listening to this need to know the real story because it's been distorted so much.
Yes.
All right, anyway, so in they go, and a lot of people don't know this, but their main objective was to take samples from the ceiling of the king's chamber. There are three chambers in the pyramid. One is the subterranean chamber underground. There is the so-called queen's chamber within the superstructure. And then, of course, the famous king's chamber, which is the highest chamber. And as you rightly pointed out, above the king's chamber are five so-called relief chambers. Mm-hmm. But I'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, so there they are. They go all the way up to the king's chamber, and the ladder is there available for them. And Dominic Gorlitz climbs the ladder, and his objective is to scrape off from the ceiling beams. Now, the ceiling beams, in fact, the whole chamber is made of solid, of blocks of granite, gigantic blocks that form the ceiling. There's nine blocks beams that weigh something like 70 tons each. It's a really massive type of construction. And the objective was to scrape off from the edges of these beams from black markings that they had seen in photographs. They suspected that these black markings might contain something that that is unusual. Anyway, so up they go. Dominic goes up the ladder, takes 14 samples from these beams. Now, the samples, frankly, I've seen photographs of them later. It's a few milligrams that is scraped off. I mean, you can't even see from when you're at the...
it's like dust. It's like a dust particle.
Yeah, I mean, if you sneeze on them, they'll disappear, if you see what I mean.
Right.
Because they were going to be examined, of course, scientifically with microscopes and so forth. Anyway, so that's what they did. They went out of the king's chamber. Apparently, they still had plenty of time with a two-hour permit, and they decided to go into the relief chambers above the king's chamber. Now, let me tell you what these things are. These chambers were discovered in 1837 by a British explorer called Howard Vyse. They were not known to exist before that time. They were sealed. Howard Vyse broke into this chamber using gunpowder. And apart from the bizarre construction, there's five chambers, one on top of the other. They're very low, by the way. You really have to crouch to be in them, except the top one. Hmm. So the top one has a pitched roof, and you can stand in there. And now, the interesting thing about these chambers, other than what do they mean, we're still not clear why they had these chambers, is that they contained graffiti painted in red ochre paint. Mm-hmm. Now, here is the thing. The graffiti appears in the last, or rather, not on the lower chamber, but in the other four chambers. The topmost chamber, the one with the pitched roof, has a very special graffiti, which is known, which, as you mentioned, it's called the cartouche. Now, a cartouche is an oval-shaped design The reason it's called cartouche, it resembles a cartridge. The French explorers called it a cartouche. Mm-hmm. And inside this oval shape is hieroglyphs that spell out the name of the king. And in this particular cartouche, in the topmost chamber, it's known as Campbell's Chamber, by the way. They give it English names by the explorer. So in Campbell's Chamber, this cartouche, which is on the south side of the chamber, on one of the beams that form the pitch or the gabled roof, has the name of Khufu. Khufu is the name of the supposed king of the fourth dynasty, who was responsible for this pyramid. And this was, to Egyptologists, the proof positive, the smoking gun, if you like, that the pyramid belonged to this particular king, King Khufu. As you may know, the Great Pyramid does not contain inscriptions either inside or outside. So this was a very big deal. It's the sort of holy grail, if you like, of pyramid exploration, because there you are, there was the name of the king, confirming at least that the pyramid was built during his reign. Mm-hmm. And above, you'll have to interrupt me if you want. One of those.
No. I want you to go. I want you to go ahead and do the preliminary, and then, of course, the accusation is the key.
I'm getting there. It's important that you know the background to all this before the accusation comes.
We're standing on pins and needles. Go ahead.
Right. I'm getting there. Don't worry. Anyway, so this cartouche is, as you appreciate, it's the signature, although it was written by a worker, it's graffiti in paint, but it is, in a sense, the signature confirming that this pyramid was built during the reign of Khufu. From an artifact, it's really worth nothing, but from its meaning, because it has that implication, of course, to Egyptology and to history. It's very, very precious. Anyway, so that's it. Now, these guys, now we come back again to these two Germans. They placed the ladder outside the king's chamber, which is at the top part of the grand gallery. And the ladder has to be attached to another ladder, because you have to climb something like 8 meters to reach a small tunnel to enter those relief chambers. So without a ladder, it can't be done. So clearly, this was all prepared for them. That's one of the problems with this accusation, is that clearly whoever organized this was in cahoot with the Germans. In any case, here they go up the ladder. It's Dominik Gorlitz again, who goes up the ladder with a filmmaker. So there's three Germans, in fact. There is Steffen Erdmann at the bottom of the ladder, Gorlitz goes up the ladder, and a filmmaker called Jan Gartlich. So that's the scene. They go up there. They're a bit confused because Steffen Erdmann, who's been in there many times, does not want to go. He gets into a panic. It's very dangerous. It's dark. So Dominik Gorlitz finds himself up there in the first chamber with the filmmaker. They're not quite clear what to do. Erdmann shouts, go to the topmost chamber, go to the southwest corner, you'll find a cartouche, and help yourself to a small sample. And so they go up there. It's quite a struggle, by the way. It's almost alpinism. You have to go through these chambers, and it's very tight, and by the time you get to the topmost chamber, you're totally exhausted. Mm. The air is very thin. And in the chamber, Dominik rushes to the southwest corner, finds a hieroglyph that looks very much what he's looking for, takes about 2 milligrams of this red oil paint. They go out, they put the sample in a little plastic container, and they go back to Germany. So that's the story. Now, here is the weird thing. They had filmed all the activities that they did in the pyramid. Their intention was to do a TV documentary. And in Germany, here they are, and they decide to do a trailer. And the trailer is put on YouTube in November, so that's several months after what they did in the pyramid. And this is where hell breaks loose, because Dr. Zahi Hawass sees this trailer, like everybody else did, as a matter of fact, and literally loses his head, and amazingly accuses me of having paid these Germans to go and steal this sample off the cartouche in order to, and here's the weird one, in order to prove that the pyramid was built by the Jews during captivity.
Okay, well, let me just stop you right there. Your book goes through quite detailed background of Hawass, his education, who he was supported by as a young student and then an Egyptologist, all the way to being part of the Supreme Council, who's in charge. Why is he accusing you, Robert Bovall, who an author of the various Giza Plateau phenomenon, why is he picking on you, is the question.
A very good question. Well, it's well known that Zahi Hawass and I have been in a head-to-head battle since the 1990s. I wrote a book in 1994 called The Orion Mystery, which was his number one bestseller and caused quite a commotion in Egyptology. You know the background to this.
Yes. This is the book that basically shows the Orion Belt is aligned with the shafts in the pyramid.
Yeah, it shows that the three pyramids on the ground form the same pattern as Orion's Belt, because, and in a nutshell, there are shafts within the pyramid that point to this particular constellation.
Right.
There are texts that tell us the king wants to go to this constellation. So anyway, from there on, it was kind of customary for Hawass and I to be pitched against each other in TV documentaries and newspapers.
Okay.
And,
all right.
But his usual accusation with me, which is very odd, was always accusing me of being a Jew and a Zionist, trying to subvert Egyptian culture and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
For you, it may sound weird, but in Egypt, this is a sort of very vilified accusation because, as you know, Egypt has been at war with Israel for several times. And so, I took it with a pinch of salt, of course, throughout the years.
Yeah.
It got very vicious in 1996 when I wrote a book with Graham Hancock called The Message of the Sphinx, and we exposed all sorts of hanky-panky that he was doing with various organizations, taking bribes and so forth. And so there you are. I mean, I'm his nemesis. I'm his Jeremy Nadler of Egyptology. So, I wasn't surprised at all that he made this accusation. What really pissed me off, if you don't mind my language, is that he said that the Germans actually had stolen the cartouche. Now, I was in Italy at the time when he gave this interview to the Egyptian papers. I was in Trieste giving a conference in the north of Italy. And, of course, I tried to find out. These Germans, I'd never heard of them. I managed to find out where Dominic Gorlitz was. He was in New York at the time, having a meeting with one of the exploration societies. And he was totally flabbergasted. I mean, although he knew of me, he couldn't understand why this accusation was made in this way. But at that point, I said, well, listen, did you guys steal the cartouche? Now, in order to steal the cartouche, you literally have to break it off the wall.
Right.
And that would be quite a job. I mean, you need some cutting tools. And so he said two things. He said, not only we didn't steal the cartouche, but we didn't even touch it. So I said, well, come on. I mean, Hawass has made this accusation. It's all over. It's gone viral. It's on BBC, CNN, Fox TV, every single newspaper. And he kept insisting we did not touch the cartouche. And in fact, he sent me pictures showing me where they took the sample. Now, to be honest, I'm a bit confused why they didn't actually take it from the cartouche. This is a fact. I'll tell you. You'll understand why in a minute. They actually went a few yards away from the cartouche, and they took it from another graffiti. It's a fact. They sent me the pictures.
Mm-hmm.
But quite honestly, at this stage, I didn't know the guys, and I wasn't too sure if they were telling me the truth. But I remembered at that point that my colleague, Robert Schock of Boston University.
Yes.
You know, the man who made the controversy over the age of the Sphinx, with John West.
We had him on the program, both him and John West.
Oh, well, so. You know Robert Schock.
Yes.
Robert is an old friend of mine, and I knew that Robert Schock had been in these chambers. I've never been, by the way.
Ah, okay.
But, it's one of those strange things. I've never been up there.
Right.
But Robert Schock had been there in 2003. In fact, I was with him in Egypt when he went there. He did a documentary with the Russian TV crew. And I knew he went there again in 2006. So I called Boston University and I asked Robert, well, listen, do you have pictures? Because, I mean, the whole point of going in Campbell's chamber is to see this cartouche and take pictures. So Robert, of course, had the pictures. And lo and behold, when he sent the pictures, in 2003, But one thing I can tell you, before I jump to tell you what these pictures proved, is that 10 days after Zahia Wad made this accusation, the Ministry of Antiquities, the new minister, sent a group of inspectors to go up there to check whether the cartouche was stolen, and in fact it was not stolen, it was there. Mm-hmm. So that changed the whole... But what they noticed is that there were some scratches on the oval that forms the cartouche. Mm-hmm. And immediately the accusation was, okay, they didn't steal the cartouche, but they took samples from it. And so I called Dominic again, Dominic Gores, and said, listen, come on, I mean, there are scratches on this cartouche. Did you or did you not take it? And he kept insisting no. So anyway, here we go to Robert Schock now. Robert Schock sends those pictures, and in 2003, when he went there, the pictures are very, very clear. He used high-definition cameras. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the cartouche in 2003 was not damaged. There was no marks of sample taking.
Okay.
However, in the picture of 2006, there were these markings as they were photographed by the inspectors when they went there after Hawass's accusation. So that was proof positive to me that the Germans, although had taken graffiti samples, they had not taken it from the cartouche. It was a fact. Mm-hmm. And so there we are at this position where it was imperative that we clear this, because as you may or may not know, a criminal case has been opened by the Egyptian authorities.
Oh, it's gone to that level, I guess, huh?
Okay. Oh, yeah. They've arrested the six Egyptians, accusing them of being in cahoots with the Germans, mm-hmm. Of having aided them to steal the cartouche, which is not true, mm-hmm. And they've been in jail since January.
Oh, my God.
And, I've been in a campaign in Egypt with the press and the various authorities there to get them out. Hmm. Unfortunately, they're still there. The trial has been postponed now to November. Hmm. And, of course, the Egyptians also opened a court case against the Germans in absentia. Hmm. The last I heard of this is that the Germans will be fined in Germany. Hmm. But the problem is this, is that it's a fact that the cartouche was not touched by these Germans. It's one of those visual facts. We have the proof, we have the signed confirmation by Robert Schock. And by the way, it isn't just Robert Schock. We managed to get other pictures from various documentaries.
Yes.
That's it. However, okay. Here's the weird thing.
Okay.
The weird thing is that we know for sure now that the cartouche has been damaged in between 2003 and 2006. And this is a problem, mm-hmm. because at that time, Zahi Hawass was responsible. So the whole focus is now shifted on who's done it between those dates and whether Hawass will take the responsibility.
Okay, so
that's the story.
Okay, yeah. so tell me that. So obviously this was a personal grudge between you and Zahi Hawass.
Yeah, believe me, if it was true, I'd be in jail. I went to Egypt several times after the accusation. Yeah. I've actually been in court to defend the Egyptians. So
that's good to know. And given his background, nothing is surprising. He's like an Egyptian Barnum and Bailey circus guy.
Well, but, you may or may not know this, but there is another investigation going on with the U.S. Department of Justice.
Yes.
Did you know this?
Yes, the one with National Geographic giving him funds.
This man has been,
We want to talk about him. But the final point that I would like to make or understand from you is the two Germans took these samples, they tested them, and what are the results? That given date of 2500 BC is wrong and it's much older? Do we have any proof of anything? Or was it just that they wanted to prove that Jews built the pyramid?
No. I know Dominic Gores very well now, and I've looked at all his documents.
Yeah.
Their intention was to test this cartouche. The problem is that, you know, it's one of those things. I gave a conference yesterday here in Minneapolis that we've known of the existence of this cartouche since 1837.
Okay.
And amazingly, there's been an accusation in the 1980s by the author Zachariah Sitchin that they might be forgeries by the British explorer who discovered them in 1837. Mm-hmm. So the only way to know for sure rather than all these theories and conspiracy theories, is to actually test the graffiti.
Now,
the problem with this graffiti is that it is red ochre. It's actually ferrous oxide. You can't carbon date ferrous oxide. But then, not long ago, it was suggested that it might have been stuck with natural resin. And for natural resin, yes, you can carbon date. So that finally, although they did do something they shouldn't have done, in many ways, I support the idea that this graffiti should have been tested. Mm-hmm. Amazingly, Egyptologists were never curious about it. But anyway, the testing. Now, you asked what the test did prove. Now,
the results
about the Jews build a pyramid and it's Atlantis. It's not at all what the Germans had in mind.
Uh-huh.
This was made up by the Chinese whisper of the media.
Mm-hmm.
What they wanted to know is whether Tatoosh was contemporary with the pyramid or whether there was good reasons to believe that it might have been a forgery.
Okay.
Now, ironically, they took the samples not from the cartouche, from a graffiti nearby. Well, at least that would have said at least the graffiti was... The problem is this, that the sample they took was not large enough. They took about 3 milligrams. It was not large enough to carbon date it properly. And the result... Well, let me tell you what they told me, okay?
Uh-huh.
So, they... And to jump the gun a bit, all these samples, by the way, have been returned now to the Egyptian authorities. However, they did test the sample, and the result of the sample is no, they couldn't get a date from it, but apparently the red ochre paint from this relief chamber, from Campbell's chamber, had a element that should not have been there, and that was aluminium. Now, they will not put their reputation on this. They definitely found traces of aluminium, but they are not sure whether the aluminium came from the spatula that they used or whether it was actually in the paint. In order to prove this, they have to go again and get another sample to be sure. If it is not from the spatula, then it of course raises a huge question. And the question would be either, yes, this graffiti is a forgery, it was paint that had aluminium in it because aluminium did not exist in the time of the pharaohs, or that it did exist at the time of the pharaohs, which would make us consider that they had a technology that we haven't worked out.
Okay, so it leaves a question.
Red ochre paint.
It leaves questions.
Hold on.
Go ahead.
The red ochre paint. Now, for the black, the samples they took from the ceiling of the King's Chamber, that's even more interesting. In fact, that was their main objective. And let me be clear on this. They took samples from the edge of the beam, and all the beams had these strange black marks on the edge as they rest on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
What they saw when they went up there at close range is that it wasn't soot, which everybody suspected. It might have been soot from torches or fires,
mm-hmm.
but it was actually something encrusted in the granite. Now, that is weird, because for something to encrust in the granite, it must be really very, very... very, very dense and strong material.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that much.
Okay.
They found something, and whatever it is, now I'm under obligation not to reveal. The reason is this. It's not because we don't want to tell you. The Egyptian authorities have insisted that if the result that they got must be published through the Egyptian Antiquity Department, and they've agreed to this.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all this legal discussions now as to how it's going to be published. But I can tell you one thing, they found something that should not be there. And that something that should not be there, in my opinion, or their opinion, and mine as well, is that it will change our perception of how this pyramid was constructed.
Mm.
In other words, what was the equipment used to cut those beams and to lift them and place them in
position? We come back to somebody like Chris Dunn's theory, perhaps.
Yes, Chris Dunn is a very good friend of mine. And
yes.
I can only say this, and I cannot tell you what it is because I would break my promise.
I understand. Listen,
but
the book that you have updated is fascinating. We don't have as much time as it would take to go through the whole book. By the way, the book is Secret Chambers Revisited, The Quest for the Lost Knowledge of Ancient Egypt. It was first written by Robert Bevall in 1999 and recently has been updated. And actually, he has a subtext, and his title is A First-Hand, Behind-the-Scenes Account of the Controversies Surrounding Modern Explorations at Giza. Now, I want to ask you, in the time we have remaining, to talk about three sections in the book that I've been fascinated with and that you have added. You more than Graham Hancock, even John Anthony West and Schock have covered some interesting areas. Now, Rudolf Gannenbrinks was a German engineer who in the late 1990s went into the Queen's Chamber, and you can give me the pretext on this, but he was able to use these robots to travel up into the shafts, and in one of his tests, he actually encountered a door. Now, what I want to ask you is, and this has been discussed by people like Chris Dunn, Robert Schock, most of the prominent alternative theorists on what the use of the Great Pyramid was for. But in your book, you reveal quite a bit of information about the Gannenbrink's discovery. Can you talk a little bit about this door and what he discovered? And also, the most prominent thing that I think you reveal that I haven't read about is the writing that was discovered on the back side of the door itself. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, again, to brief you very on this matter, Rudolf Gannenbrink was working under the aegis of the German Archaeological Institute. Mm-hmm. I met him a couple of weeks before he started the exploration of the shafts in the Queen's Chamber. There are shafts that shoot out of the Queen's Chamber, and they do not pierce the pyramid. They stop somewhere inside. Nobody knew how far they went and what was at the end of them. There are shafts, of course, in the King's Chamber, but these pierce the pyramid right through. So there you are. And again, one of these strange situations where these shafts were known to exist since 1872, and yet nobody had bothered to explore them. So here is Rudolf Gannenbrink in 1993, to be precisely in March, and he has built a small machine, a little robotic machine. He called it Whoop-O-Wet 2, and managed to get this this machine all the way up to the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber, 60 meters deep into the core of the pyramid, and to the surprise of everybody, found a small trap door. It's about 8 inches by 8 inches in rectangle, with two metal handles. Of course, I was the man with the Gannenbrink who brought this story to the media. It went viral, of course, in those days. That was before the internet, by the way. So
yes.
It was picked up by everything. Well, as you can imagine, a door inside the Great Pyramid was a huge sensation.
Yes.
And followed a huge polemics as to who was going to open this door. The whole thing deteriorated into a political battle with Zahi Abbas and myself. And anyway, 10 years later, Gannenbrink has abandoned the chase. He was totally disgusted with all this hanky-panky. And the job was done, it was given to the National Geographic Society to do a live show. They had built another machine, and they announced that we're going to open this door. I don't know if you remember, this was in 2002.
Yes.
And it was quite a hyped program. Incidentally, this is why there is the U.S. Department of Justice investigation, is that we didn't know at the time that they had agreed with Hawass to pay him a stipend of something like $200,000 for life. So,
was that an annual payment?
Yes, yes.
Oh
yes,
my God!
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. He was nominated explorer in exploring residence of the National Geographic Society emeritus. That means for life.
Yes.
And I haven't seen the contract they have with him, but basically he was getting $200,000 a year. Anyway, that's another story. So the National Geographic did a live show. I happened to be there, by the way. I was, of course, very curious to see what they were going to do. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they got to what we call now the Gannenbrink door, and instead of trying to open it, they drilled a small hole, and they inserted the fiber optic camera. and this was all live, by the way, and to the surprise of everybody, 50 centimeters away from the Gantenbrück door was another door. So that was that. They explored the northern shaft, but this was not on TV. They did this on the quiet. Mm-hmm. And in the northern shaft, again at the same distance, about 60 meters deep, they found another door.
Hmm.
So there we are in 2002 with two doors on each side of the pyramid at the end of the shaft and a second door behind the Gantenbrück door. And then here we go, waiting another 10 years. Don't ask me why, but all sorts of conundrum started again. But basically, 10 years later, to be precise, in 2010, just a few months before the revolution, by the way,
mm-hmm.
Hawass had contracted a group of scientists from Leeds University in England, who had again built a third machine. And the idea was that they were going to try and lift that door, the Gantenbrück door, and see what was beyond the second door. But in fact, what they did was again to insert a fiber optic camera. But this time, the fiber optic camera could swivel around.
Mm.
And to the surprise of everybody, on the floor was three hieroglyphs in red graffiti, in red ochre. Again, this graffiti thing that we talked about earlier.
We're going to take a short break, and we will be right back with Robert Bevall talking about the Great Pyramid in Egypt. We'll be right back with you. We're listening to Robert Bevall in a recording that was done in 2014. I have not heard from Robert since this interview, and we're hoping he's well. But we get a good sense of not only the Egyptological reaction to new ideas, but also we hear from Robert directly on his theory and his understanding of what the Great Pyramid was used for, how it was constructed, and its unique features.
Okay, so before we describe this graffiti, tell us again, this is a shaft in the Queen's Chamber. Is it facing east, west, north, south?
No, it's facing south.
It's facing south.
And let me tell you, the curious thing about this shaft, I'm the discoverer of the alignment of this shaft.
Yes.
I published an article in 1990 showing that the shaft, because we know that these shafts in the King's Chamber and in the Queen's Chamber were pointed to star systems that were very important to the Egyptians for their rebirth rituals.
Right.
They had this kind of stellar cult in which the pharaoh was going to be converted into a spiritual star being.
Okay.
Anyway, the shaft in the Queen's Chamber, I discovered, and this is well accepted in Egyptology, pointed to the star Sirius. The star Sirius is a star of rebirth identified to the goddess Isis. So that makes this shaft very, very mysterious, because whatever might be behind this door has something to do with the rebirth ritual.
Hmm.
And your guess is as good as mine before you ask me. But anyway, this hieroglyph. Now, let me tell you that for many, many years, architects, mathematicians, and engineers have known that the pyramid is designed using prime numbers. In other words, that whoever designed this pyramid, for some reason, used prime numbers, and the unit they used in those days was known as the royal cubit. And now prime numbers is very interesting, because prime numbers indicates to any scientist today are very, very special numbers that would indicate if you use them in a series, for example, if you use 3, 7, 11, and so forth, the numbers that are not divisible by themselves. They're not divisible into two bits.
Okay.
So you have 3, 7, 11, and you go on. Now, the odd thing is that the numbers that are encountered most in the design of the pyramid is 7 and 11. That's very, very interesting, because here is the big surprise. It's always been suspected that there is some sort of code that there is some sort of code in this design, that it might be a message in prime numbers, in mathematical form. There are other strange constants in the design of the pyramids, such as the value pi and the golden section, the Fibonacci series. And these have justifiably been seen as maybe a certain language that is used mathematically. Now, the big surprise to everybody is that these three hieroglyphs behind the Gantific door are numbers. And again, to the surprise of everybody, there are three numbers. 1, 20, and 100, which form the number 120, which is, of course, 11 squared, 11 times 11. And now, of course, everybody is thinking that this might be the actual code, the key to decipher this monument. And that's where we all stand today.
Okay.
I must say that it's very, very intriguing, because here we have a monument that responds to astronomy very intensely. It's aligned to the cardinal direction with high precision. It has shaft pointing to star systems, Orion's belt, the star Sirius, the circumpolar stars. And then this prime number design. In short, the pyramid is expressing itself in a universal language, and that is very, very interesting. And of course, whatever is behind this door might resolve the mystery that that we're all trying to solve.
It's curious. Now, for the benefit of our audience who haven't read your work, Robert, would you tell us, please, what your feeling for the Great Pyramid is? In other words, Dunn felt it was a power generator. A number of others have felt that it dealt with, it was a pump of some kind. In fact, there's even an American engineer who's built a pump that simulates what the various shafts were used for. What is your feeling on the actual creation? What was the creation of this massive structure for? And if you could also enlighten us, what is your feeling of its, who are the creators? Now, most feel this beyond pre-dynastic Egypt, by several thousands of years, but what is your feeling on that?
Okay, let me start with a metaphor. I was, in fact, with Robert Schock a few months ago in Bulgaria, and to cut a long story short, the organizer of our visit was a musician from the Sofia Philharmonic Orchestra. And he told us about, he was a clarinet player, and he told us all about this, how he played clarinet and played Mozart in concerts and so forth. He explained about the frequency and all this business. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to us that if we were given a clarinet, I mean, I have no idea, I can't play musical instruments, I can't even read music. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know what to do with it. The pyramid is an instrument. It's an instrument, and we don't have the player. It's clearly intended, it has a function. Now, the function, I'm the sort of person who sticks to the context. We have texts that speak about the ideologies of the pyramid builders, although not in the Great Pyramid, but pyramids of the 5th dynasty. Now, Giza, the pyramids of Giza, the pyramids of Khufu is from the 4th dynasty. The 5th dynasty pyramids are loaded with inscriptions. They're known as the pyramid texts. And there it is very, very clear. They're a very obscure text, of course, they're very occult, they're meant for high initiates, but it's very clear to understand that the intention of the pyramids were to convert the physical dead body of the king into a stellar entity so that he could depart into the sky and join his ancestors, his divine ancestors in the sky, in that region of the sky where the constellation of Orion is. So that's what they tell us. Mm-hmm. The big question is, did they do it? You know, or is it just mere superstition? There's something about the Great Pyramid that, let me tell you this, because for many of your listeners who have not been there, I was born in Egypt, by the way. Mm-hmm. And I decided to write a book. I wrote several books between 2006 and 2008, literally in an apartment that was literally in front of the Great Pyramid. I spent my days, my evenings, my breakfast next to this monument. And it is a monument that no matter how many times you visit it, no matter how many times you see it, it's baffling. It's like it shouldn't be there.
Right.
It's too big. It's too precise. It's too mysterious. We're here in the 21st century. There's been thousands and thousands of researchers trying to figure it out. We don't even know how it was built, let alone its function. But if we stick to the what the Egyptians themselves say, it served as a metaphysical machine, if you can call it that, as a resurrection machine, if you can call it that, as a transformation machine, to do what they say is to convert the physical body into an astral entity. And that's what it's for, according to them. And when you go in there, when you visit, have you been in there, by the way?
I have not had a chance to visit.
Hey, come on my tours.
Okay, well,
I was in there with a group of 15 Americans last week.
Uh-huh.
I was actually in the Great Pyramid, in the King's Chamber, there with 15 people. And let me tell you, I visited the pyramid thousands of times, but the same sensation grabs you. You just can't figure out the interior design of this monument. It's totally bizarre. I mean, you enter through an ascending passage, which you have to crouch. You emerge into this giant grand gallery, which is about almost 50 meters long. It's 9 meters high. It's almost like a cathedral within the pyramid, amazingly designed with corbelled blocks forming a corbelled ceiling. You can't even pass a blade through these rocks, blocks that weigh 60 to 70 tons. It's one of the strange, and totally bare. It's like you're inside a musical instrument. There's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing has ever been found. You feel like you're in some sort of machine.
Yeah.
And then you emerge from the Grand Gallery, crouch again, go through the various passages, and emerge into this King Chamber, which is made of solid granite, blocks that weigh 60 to 70 tons, with just an empty box. And you get this feeling, as weird as it may seem, and let me tell you this, because I'm an engineer, and I'm one of these annoyingly skeptical person when we start talking metaphysics.
Yeah.
But you can't escape this feeling that these people, however strange it may seem, may have succeeded in finding a way to do what they say they were doing with this monument. Now, I know a lot of people were jumping on this one, but that's the feeling you get. It's like there was something in there that they took in there. They tell us that they took the physical body of the king, and then it's not there anymore. The pyramid was sealed. That's the weird thing about the pyramid. It was sealed. It was only opened up in the 9th century.
Mm-hmm.
The relief chambers were sealed, as I was telling you. They were opened in 1837. The shafts were sealed. Nobody could have gone inside this pyramid for thousands of years, and yet it was empty, totally empty. Now, it's certainly a lot of wasted energy and material and effort to build a monument and put nothing inside it.
Yeah.
So all I can tell you is that and I'm going to get pillared on this, but now I'm talking metaphysics because I'm obliged to do so. All I can tell you is that the impression you get is that the Egyptians somehow succeeded in doing what they said they were doing. Now, how they did it, I have no idea. And that's where I stop.
Okay, you know? So in other words, what you're saying is they figured out a way to transmute flesh into some other vibration or something. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, you're looking at the hardware. I'm looking at my little computer on my desk right now.
Yeah.
And basically it's made of plastic, metal, and that's it.
Yeah.
Now to get this thing started, I need energy. I need to plug it in with batteries or through the mains. And when I've got that plugged, I need a processor to make it work and a program. What we're looking at the pyramid is literally the hardware. We don't have the energy. We don't know what the energy is. And we certainly don't know what the program is. All I can tell you is that from their texts, that they needed somehow to align it to the cardinal direction. They needed to have shafts pointing to certain stars.
Mm-hmm.
They needed to have prime numbers to design this monument. In other words, that all this put together formed the machine, if you like, this metaphysical machine. Mm-hmm. And what we don't have today is the energy, whatever it took to get it started.
Okay,
that's how it feels.
Okay, let me just conclude with that. Let me ask one more question of that, and then I'm going to ask you to, as quickly as you can, discuss the Hermetic wisdom or the text that are a big part of this book that you've written. But before we go to the Hermetic Wisdom, I want you to tell me what your feeling is, and our audience wants to hear from you, who built that monument. It's so radically different than anything else there, except maybe the Osirian, which is Osirian. Is that how you pronounce it?
The Osirian in Osirian, Abydos.
Which is made of megaliths of pure granite and stacked in such a way that it doesn't seem like it's from dynastic Egypt at all. But anyhow, what is your conclusion after you've been there for so many years? I mean, do you feel that it is from a race of beings who had an engineering genius? And
No doubt.
A subtle wisdom to be able to say, look, here, as you say, Robert, here is the mechanism. All we need is the software or the infusion of some chemical combination or whatever to activate this device. So who built it? That's the question. Quickly.
Yeah, very quickly. I mean, the funny thing about the pyramid is, as I said, it's anonymous. But having said this, we know that the Egyptians themselves of that epoch were very fond of writing. We have monuments that are before the Great Pyramid. If we accept the chronology of the Egyptologists, which places it in 2500 BC, in the epoch of King Khufu, well, we have monuments, we have actual tombs around the Great Pyramid that contain texts. And then, of course, as I said, we have pyramids that follow the Great Pyramid loaded with texts, the pyramid texts. So why is this monument anonymous? Totally anonymous. I mean, it doesn't make sense. If I was the commissioner of this monument, and I would want people to know that I'm the man who built it.
Yeah.
Nothing. It doesn't contain nothing. Not only no text, but nothing. It's totally bare. It's one of those great mysteries. It's as if it's challenging us. It's a challenge. It's a kind of work me out, figure it out, find out what I mean, find out who put me there.
Yeah.
And we are the custodians after thousands of years with the right technology, or I think we have enough technology to work it out. The big problem is that the Egyptian authorities have put a blockade, and particularly Dr. Zahi Hawass. He hasn't allowed, as you know, people like Robert Schock, John West, Graham Hancock, myself, to get anywhere near. Yes, we can visit it, but we need to go with instruments, we need to go with sonar instruments, we need to go with radars. And he hasn't allowed this. And without that, you know, our hands are tied. I'm sure that this monument contains a huge surprise. It's too big. It's too precise. It's too mysterious. You know, and we have those doors. I mean, maybe that would solve the mystery. And then again, we're 20 years after the discovery of the doors, and they're still closed. So all I can tell you is that from a gut feeling, whoever designed, let alone build this monument, were geniuses. Geniuses that don't fit the context that Egyptologists tell us. I mean, they're telling us that we're dealing with an epoch that there was no wheel, there was no pulleys, there was no iron, there was no bronze. In fact, there was nothing. Yeah. There was brutal manpower and strings and pieces of wood. You can't build this monument with that context.
Yes.
As you may know, I'm a construction engineer by profession. I would be baffled to try and construct a monument of that size and that accuracy without any equipment.
Yeah.
I really wouldn't know where to start. So we've got a huge mystery here, and I think that, to me, this is the crime, is that if we don't try and solve it, and we accept it as being some sort of bizarre tomb for a pharaoh, maybe in 1,000 years, maybe in 2,000 years, people will blame us for not working it out. Maybe it has a message for the planet. I don't know. But that's the impression you get.
Very good. That is something to think about. It may have something encoded that when decoded, it has a message for those of us living on the Earth.
I'll tell you what the message reads so far from the astronomy. It's giving us a date of 10,500 BC. Mm-hmm. It's giving us coordinates in the sky, pointing at specific constellations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's giving us a mathematical language which we haven't yet understood that may explain why they're doing this. I mean, what more mystery do you want? I mean, to me it's incredible that here the human race, we're in the 21st century, we know of how our galactic system is formed. We know there are exoplanets. Mm-hmm. We know there is a mystery. We don't even know our origins. We have no idea where the human race comes from. And here is this monument standing in the desert with all these factors.
Yes.
It may be what the Egyptologists say, but then it may not be.
Yes.
And we'll be blamed for not having tried to work it out.
You know, so much of your book does discuss the curious behavior of the Egyptian hierarchy, which at one time was under Zahi Hawass. In fact, that you even get into the Americans' issues with Mark Lerner, who's a most prominent American Egyptologist. But I would rather leave that for our readers to actually grasp and understand, even though it's a huge part of the book that you have written, and it's a very important part because, as you say, we are being blocked from discovering the true purpose beyond conventional Egyptologist education. And my biggest problem as a researcher in the Central American area is the anthropologists and the archaeologists are limited in their education and are afraid to go beyond that unless it's proven to them that there is evidence for an alternative theory, alternative information, alternative data to consider. But as a rule, Egyptologists and classically trained Orthodox anthropologists and archaeologists are very afraid to take alternative views of their of ancient buildings, and that's a real problem.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I mean, on the one hand, you can't blame them. I mean, of course, you can't let anybody come and mess around with these monuments, which is one, a great part of my book, by the way, because a lot of people have been allowed to mess around with these monuments who should not have.
Yeah.
However, yes, it's true, and I fully support the professionals who are reticent to hand over these monuments to amateurs mm-hmm. or people who don't know what they're doing. But, you know, Robert Schock is not an amateur. Graham Hancock is a professional journalist who's proved his worth. I'm a construction engineer. And besides, I mean, any exploration or any investigation will be supervised and properly done under the Antiquity Department. So we're not talking about Indiana Jones going there with lassos and gunpowder and blasting our way into it. We're talking about proper, well-organized expeditions, probably through universities or institutions. Having said this, there is a problem, and the problem is peer pressure. There is a consensus that's been established that they're very reluctant to alter. I mean, all the textbooks will have to be changed if this pyramid is much older, if the Egyptian chronology that they've established is wrong. So, you know, of course, there's huge resistance. But, you know, like we always say, truth is truth. There's one thing that isn't democratic in this world, by the way, and that's truth. You don't vote on truth. You don't have Egyptologists saying, we have a consensus on truth. You know, if one person is right, then it doesn't matter if there's a million people who are wrong.
Yeah.
We know this from history. You know, we have Copernicus, we have Newton, we have Galileo. You know, that the whole society were against them, but they were right. And here we are. You know, there are people who do have very good research, very good ideas. I mean, for example, take my case. I've fought for 30 years to finally get Egyptologists and other archaeologists who are working on these monuments to consider astronomy. Astronomy is clearly a key factor to understand these monuments. But before that, you know, they were poo-pooing astronomy because, you know, they were saying, you know, astrologists and charlatans and nutcases and so forth. So there's been some progress, but there you are. It's one of those very difficult things. And I have to say this. I'm one of these delighted people who is very happy that Zahi Hawass is out of the way. So perhaps now, with a more reasonable and more organized new minister, we may get some head-on on this.
Okay. So in the final couple of minutes that we have left, Robert, and I'd love to talk to you directly about Zahi Hawass. I think that he is has been a problem for as long as he's been on the Supreme Council. But let's talk really quickly about a portion of your book that does apparently relate to the Great Pyramid and some of the other anomalous features on the Giza Plateau, and that's the Hermetic Wisdom. Can you tell us just a little bit about what you have discovered and its importance in understanding the pyramid?
Well, the Hermetic text, as you know, were written in Alexandria. I'm from Alexandria, by the way. I was born in Alexandria. And had been lost for over 1,500 years. They were rediscovered in Italy in the Renaissance in Florence, and hit the scene because these texts, when they were read by the Italian philosophers, completely surprised them because they were highly sophisticated ideas. But one of the tenets of the Hermetic text is as above, so below. There seems to be an insistence by ancient Egyptians through these Hermetic texts and many other cultures, by the way, that there is some sort of correlation between what goes on in the sky and what goes on the ground. Now, we know there is, of course. We're affected by the seasons. We're affected by the change in weather caused by the gyration of our planet and its rotation. But they seem to think there was something much more, something to do with the spirit. And what the Hermetic text, in a context, since you asked me to go very, very quickly on this,
They
suggest that man has a divine spark, that through knowledge, through the search for gnosis, as they call it, the Greeks, the search for knowledge, and not just knowledge outside, the knowledge within us, you can reach that divine spark. In other words, that humanity can become divine. Its goal is to transcend the state they're in, this state that we're caught, that we don't know our origins, we don't know what's after death, and reach the divine status. I recommend, by the way, that people should read this text. They're very, very inspiring, because it gives a vision that the human race is capable of some amazing mission, which is the quest for divinity, the quest for immortality, the quest of reaching our final destination, to know who we are through that Gnostic search. So there you are. That's in a nutshell what I think of the Hermetic text. There's a lot more, of course, but
okay.
I don't think we have the time.
No, thank you very much. The book is called Secret Chambers Revisited, The Quest for the Lost Knowledge of Ancient Egypt. The author is my guest, Robert Bevall. Robert, where are you going to be? You're going to be in the States for a few weeks or months or just a couple of days?
The conference in Minneapolis finishes tomorrow. I'm staying another few days. I want to see the lake areas.
Mm-hmm.
I take the opportunity to visit a bit more. But may I say that, may I blow my trumpet?
Please, no, I want you to tell us what you're up to, the books, websites.
Well,
let us know what you're all.
Well, I would like to say that for those listeners who are interested to see this on location, who want to visit the pyramid and see what's inside, see with your own eyes, then I conduct tours in Egypt. I conduct tours in March and in September.
Okay.
So please, if you're interested, go on my website, which is robertbevall.co.uk, not .com. You're going to get some pornographic site. Somebody pinched my site. But it's www.robertbevall.co.uk. You've got to have this on your bucket list. The Egypt, and especially the Great Pyramid, is a must. You've got to do it.
Okay.
It changes your whole perception. I had 15 people coming with me last week in Egypt, and it's changed their life. I'm getting emails every day saying, you know, I've become a kind of schizophrenic. I'm living half in Egypt and half in Egypt. Yeah. It has this effect on you. It's true.
Wow.
Once you've been inside the Great Pyramid, you'll never be the same.
Wow.
Okay, well, listen, this was great.
It was fantastic. Thank you for joining us, Robert. I really appreciate the interview. This will be posted. I will send a copy to the Barron Company, Inner Tradition, so that you get a copy. And much success. And one of these days, I hope to meet with you.
Well, come on my tours.
I definitely do that.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Robert.
Great. Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For any of you that is interested in Bevall's work, his early research and collaborations with noted alternative historians and scientists is the foundation for a lot of our thinking on Egypt the Great Pyramids and a lot of the other buildings and structures that were built by a people that are not recognized as the dynastics. The Egyptology departments would like us to consider, and they are advocates for the dynastics building all these amazing buildings. But the dynastics under the pharaonic leadership just didn't have the technology or the science to build the Great Pyramid, to build like the Osirian or the great temples, most notably the Hathor Temple in Dendera. And then on and on and on. There's just too many problems when you consider copper chisels, dorite balls as the form of technology used to carve sophisticated obelisks and 50-ton blocks of red granite. It's just not possible. So all we can do is hope at some point that there will be a discovery made that shows that they were people prior to the dynastics, prior to the Egyptians that we know. Because as it stands right now, most of us in the alternative science field or research believe that there was a whole different science and physics behind the great buildings that we see now. And that Seti I, Khufu, Ramses II, these great builders basically inherited these buildings, pyramids, and in many cases, these beautiful statues, the statuary, and simply placed their cartouche behind them or on these on the statuary, which doesn't really identify them as the builders or the ones who asked for the artisans to build or carve these buildings. It just kind of gives them a leg up on the predecessors or those people in the future to make us think that they were the ones who had the artisans build or carve these statues. Unfortunately, you know, Egyptology just doesn't want to have anyone else look at this stuff. And when an engineer says, look, there's no way that this was carved by a dynastic, they can't deal with it. They simply can't deal with it. And this is why, again, without belaying the issue any further, Egyptology just can't last under these current conditions and under these current intellectual streams of consciousness. It's like they're in the dark ages. All right, I hope you enjoyed that. Again, if you're interested in Egypt and in Egypt history, go to Amazon, look up Robert Bavall. Let's start with The Orion Mystery, which is co-written by Graham Hancock. Very well-written book. And it sets the stage for a lot of discoveries that came decades later. So I hope you enjoyed that. Hey, I want to remind you, our fourth annual Grand Egyptian Tour is coming up. It's been announced. It's May 2nd through the 14th, 2022. We all meet in Cairo. This is a five-star, what we call a diplomatic tour. It is not to be missed. We're only taking around 30, 35, maybe 40 people this time, and we're a third full. If you did not hear the announcement on Earth Ancients, there is an additional discount on top of the already inexpensive fee to actually come with us. If you're interested and you want more information, send me an email at cliff@earthancients.com. Or simply go to Earth Ancients on the Facebook page, and all the details are there. But I suggest going to earthancients.com/tours, see the itinerary, read all about it. You get a discount. There's an additional early bird special if you want it and you didn't hear the show. Again, email me at cliff@earthancients.com and tell me why you're asking for the code. Cliff, I want to go to the tour. I want that extra couple hundred bucks discount, which makes it very, very inexpensive to join us. So again, it's the Grand Egyptian Tour for May 2nd to the 14th, and it is not to be missed. All right, that's it for this program. I want to thank Robert Bavall Robert, I hope you're doing well, and let's get you back as soon as we can. As always, the team of Ruth Thomas, Mark Foster, and the other group members who make this happen. Thank you, guys. You rock. All right, take care, be well, and we'll talk to you next time.